Welcome to Milk and Honey with Jesse Shazlow, the show all about Israel, anti-Semitism, and Jewish culture. Sponsored by the Jewish Federation of Sarasota Manatee. Now, here's your host, Jesse Shazlow.
Good morning, and welcome to Milk and Honey, sponsored by the Jewish Federation of Sarasota Manatee. I'm Joan Lowry, your guest host for today's program. Once a month, Milk and Honey focuses on the Holocaust. Our interviews are pre-recorded, as they're also part of video testimonies being archived by the Florida Holocaust Museum. Today's guest is Sonia Pressman Fuentes. Sonia, her parents, and her brother Herman fled Germany right before the Holocaust and ultimately made it to the United States in 1938. Their story is one of oppression, persistence, resourcefulness, and ultimately success. Good morning, Sonia.
Good morning. And we came to the United States in 1934.
Oh, in 1934. Okay, we'll backtrack and check that out. Thank you for telling me that. Let's begin by your telling me about your father, Zisha's childhood in the Jewish shtetl in Pilz, Poland.
Well, the Jews called it Pilz. The non-Jewish Poles called it Pilica. My mother and father were both born in this shtetl. I don't know anything about my paternal grandfather, but my paternal grandmother ran a bakery there.
And was your paternal grandfather alive as your father was growing up, or didn't he die?
I don't know a thing about my paternal grandfather.
Okay. And what about your father's education?
My father never had any education. He never attended any school whatsoever in his entire life.
Really? Was that typical in the shtetl?
Probably. I'm thinking it was probably, although I know some people did go to schools, because we always met people who said they went to the gymnasium and that kind of thing, but gymnasium there meant school, but my father never went to any school, and my mother attended some elementary schools in Poland because she had uncles who were teachers.
Okay, and we're gonna focus on your father to begin with.
Okay.
Because I understand at the very young age of 14, he decided to emigrate to Germany, but that's after he had some tailoring under his belt. So tell me about his early career prior to the age of 14.
Well, he began as a youngster delivering clothes for a tailor. He didn't really do any tailoring. He delivered clothes for a tailor, like if you ordered a suit, he would deliver it. Mm-hmm. And then when he was 14, he indeed did decide to immigrate is too fancy of a word. He decided to cross the border illegally and go to Germany because he thought he would have better job opportunities there.
So he was very career-minded at such a young age.
It wasn't career-minded. He was interested in making more money and having a better job.
Right. Was he raised religious, orthodox in any way?
My parents practiced a form of religion which I guess is somewhat close to Orthodox, but I don't even know if they knew about Orthodox versus conservative or whatever. They were just shtetl Jews. And I can tell you about their synagogue going later on, but I don't know really how he was raised.
How did his mother feel about his leaving at 14 years old?
I have no idea.
You have no idea.
That part I don't know.
So the trip to Germany, or the smuggling into Germany, rather, was quite... Tell us about that.
Well, so he ran across the border illegally, and there were some policemen or guards there, and they shot at my father. And they put some bullet holes through the hat he was wearing, and the hat fell off his head. So... But he was able to continue on to Germany, but those policemen brought the hat back to his mother, and she assumed he'd been killed. Mm. My father got to Germany, but since he didn't know how to read or write, he didn't communicate with his mother, because he had no way of doing so. So as far as she knew, he had died crossing the border.
What year was this?
Well, my father was born in 1893, and he was 14 when he crossed the border, so you can do the math.
Right. Okay. So he was in what city in Germany?
I don't know where he first went. Uh-huh. He might have been in a few places after he married my mother. I know they lived in Frankfurt am Main for a while because my brother was born there. So well, how did he, yeah, I think they were in various cities.
So how did he survive once he got to Germany?
So he had one or more jobs, and he began to learn to be a tailor. And he worked himself up to being a foreman in some kind of a shop. And he, when I knew him, he was very proficient. My father could make a suit, and he could make a man's coat, and he could make women's things also. There was nothing about men's clothing that my father couldn't do. And he learned all that on the job.
Do you have any idea of what his living conditions were like at age 14 in Germany?
I don't know anything about
nothing.
That.
Nothing. But he built himself up to be quite comfortable in Germany.
Well, that was many years later when they were well-to-do. At this point, I don't know how well he was doing, but he was apparently making a living because he was able to come back and marry my mother. But
so tell us, how did he come back? What happened?
So when he was about 18 or... Well, I haven't told you anything about my mother.
We'll get to that.
Okay. So he was about 18 or 19. He decided to return to Pilz to see his mother. So he came to Pilz and he knocked on the door of his mother's house, and she opened the door and saw him and say, "Ghost." She said, "Ghost," like this, "go back to your caver," which Ooh. Is must be a Hebrew or a Yiddish word for where somebody's buried or something. She thought he had died and he was a ghost. So he had to explain to his mother that he wasn't a ghost, he wasn't killed, and then he came in the house.
So at that point, while he was on that visit back in Pilz, he somehow met your mother. Tell me about your mother, though, before we go into their meeting, what her life was like.
Okay, well, my mother was born in Pilz also. She was born in 1892. She was about a year or something older than my father. And she lived with her father and mother. And when my mother was 10 years, and her father was, the Yiddish word or the Polish word is batkin, is one of the words. And there's another word for it. My grandfather went around to weddings and bar mitzvahs and told jokes and sang songs.
Oh, interesting, huh?
And marshalik is the other word I was thinking of.
Which means?
Batkin or marshaling. Marshalik, and it's the kind of person who goes around and entertains.
Right.
So he didn't make a lot of money at that. So when my mother was 10 years old, her mother died. Mm-hmm. And at some point thereafter, I'm guessing not too long after, her father remarried. And he married a woman who had a daughter of her own. So that woman didn't need my mother in the house because she had her own daughter. So she was the typical stepmother, or typical in literature,
right?
And did not have a good relationship with my mother, and didn't really want my mother there. So one time my mother told me she was studying Chumash.
What is Chumash?
It's some kind of, I think, the books of the Torah or something like that.
She read. She did have an education, somewhat.
Well, she must have been able to read, but as I told you, she only had a smattering of some elementary school grades. When her father came home that day, the stepmother complained that my mother was studying out loud and it was giving her a headache. So my maternal grandfather took my mother by the hair and threw her across his room. Mm. So she went outside and sat on a stoop and started to cry. And she had a wealthy uncle from Warsaw. He was a brother to her late mother. And he happened to be coming visiting that day, and he saw my mother sitting on the stoop crying. And he said, "Lonishu, why are you crying?" So she told him what had happened with her father and that he had thrown her across the room. And he said he would take her to live with him and his family in Warsaw.
Lucky for her. So they raised her?
So she went to live with them in Warsaw. It was the uncle, the aunt, and they had a son and a daughter. The son was called Dalek, the daughter was called Helcha, and my mother was a sort of a combination, poor relation and servant, but they treated her very well.
What was your mother's name?
Hindeleia.
Hindeleia. So how did she end up coming back to Pilz and meeting your father?
Well, one occasion, she returned to Pilz to visit her father, and my father came from Germany to visit his mother. And my mother had a cousin who was a shotgun, a matchmaker. And he suggested to my mother that she meet my father. So they met, and they took a walk. And during this walk, my mother asked my father how much money he earned at his work. So he said to me he didn't want her being interested in him for his money, so he gave her a lower figure than he made. And then he took out of his pocket, he took out a picture of himself and showed it to her. And she said, that's very nice. And she went to return it to him. And he said to her, no, you may keep it. So she said to herself, oh, this guy must be interested in me. So she kept the picture. And then she went back to Warsaw and he went to Germany.
We're going to follow up the story. Obviously, they got together, but we have to take a short break. I want to thank Triforce Pictures for their generosity in providing video and audio services for the Holocaust testimonies. This is Milk and Honey on WSRQ, the voice of Sarasota Manatee. Welcome back to Milk and Honey. I'm your host, Joan Lowry. I'm talking with Sonia Pressman Fuentes about how her parents met in Poland. And we were just about talking about they met one day in Pilz. Her father went back to Germany. And why don't you finish that story with they started writing and how they ended up getting married?
So after that, they corresponded, but my father didn't know how to write. So he had friends of his who, on his behalf, sent my mother. They had in Germany these postcards. On one side was a romantic picture of a man wooing a woman, and on the other side, you would write a message. So the friends wrote these messages, and my mother received them as if they were from my father. And she wrote back, and then on one postcard, he started it with calling her darling. So she wrote back and said, you can't call me darling, it's not proper. And he wrote back and said, it's okay for me to call you darling because we're going to be married.
And she agreed, obviously.
And she agreed.
So did she then, how did they end up in Germany? Because she didn't have a legal pass to Germany. So he took her to Germany.
Well, so you want me to skip all that part about
yes.
the wedding. So I don't know anything about the legalities. Mm-hmm. He also, when he left Germany to go to Pilz and get married, the boss of his place said that he could not leave at that time. It was a busy season and they needed him. And my father said, I can always get another job, but I can't always get another wife. And he left. So he came and they got married. I'm not telling that story unless you want me to. And then they went back to Germany, but I don't know anything about the legalities.
So somehow they got back to Germany.
Right.
They moved to Frankfurt.
I don't know where they moved initially. Well, that's right, because a year later, my brother was born,
brother
and he was
Herman.
Born in Frankfurt.
Right, and your father started his own business at
no,
that
No, I don't
point?
Know what he did different things until mm-hmm. they came to Berlin. I don't know what
okay.
he was doing, but it was in men's clothing.
Okay, and then when did they move to Berlin and what happened?
I don't know when they moved to Berlin, but they were living there in 1928 because that's where I was born.
And you were born. And once in Berlin, your father became quite successful.
Yes.
How and what did he do?
Well, I don't know what he did before I came along.
Right.
But when I came along in 1928, they were well-to-do. My father was renting and managing a men's clothing store with a small factory in the back. Both my mother and brother helped him in the business. And they had at least a maid in the house and maybe more, but I know there was always a maid in the house. And my father had just bought for investment, I was born in 28, and somewhere around 1933, he had bought a building for investment purposes, which had 40 apartments and 4 stores.
Amazing, amazing. This man who had no education was able to build himself up so quickly. Now,
not so quickly.
Well, relatively speaking, a lot of people never achieve that in a lifetime. So in 1933, everything started to change when Hitler came to power. So bring us up to date about what happened then.
Well, Hitler was named Reich Chancellor on January 30th, 1933. And my brother started keeping a diary in German shorthand, which I have, in 1932. And when Hitler was made Reich Chancellor, my brother immediately saw the threat to the Jews. And he said to my parents, we have to leave here. And we also, my brother also saw a number of incidents of people we knew that we did business with, and things were happening to them. Jewish people. One man was taken away several times, and then he was killed, and his wife had to sign a paper that he died of natural causes. And there was another situation where a Jewish man that they knew, his ring was taken off his finger, and I don't know what happened. Remember what happened to that.
Was your brother working for your father?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes. And I think the triggering incident was that a group of thugs came into our store, some of whom had worked in the store in the past. And they came to steal suits and coats and whatever they could. And they planned to, and the building where that store and factory were located used to be a Dresden bank. So in Germany was the Dresdner Bank. And there was a vault in the back. So they planned to put my brother and my father into that vault and to steal what they could. But my brother ran into his office and he called the police. And the police came and they chased away those thugs. But they said to my father, Herr Pressman, if such a thing happens again, don't call us because you're Juden.
Scary, very scary. Now, were your parents living in a Jewish community, or were they pretty assimilated into the German culture?
I just know, and it's in my book, I know the address where they were living. I was to Germany a couple of times to visit, and I think it was a place where Jews lived. But I don't really know anything about it.
Okay.
But
so
I had the address, and I visited there.
So your brother gets the message loud and clear.
Right.
And
And my father, so we said to my father, we have to leave. And my father said, are you kidding? You know, he'd been living in Germany about 20 years by that time. And had a good life, making a good living. He said, this Hitler will just blow over. So my brother decided to go by himself. He was 19, I would say, at that time. He wanted to go to London, but he couldn't get permission to go to London. He couldn't get a visa. So he went to Antwerp, Belgium, where we had some cousins. But he only had like a 3 or 4 day tourist visa to go to Antwerp.
So then but he stayed.
So we went to Antwerp and he communicated with my parents and a short time passed and my mother asked him to come back. She said they needed him for help in the business and that things were better now. And my brother wrote back and said that he read in the papers that when Jews who have left Berlin come back, the Nazis are waiting for them at the railroad station and they're never seen again. But my brother said, so I don't want to come back. But my brother said, if you order me to come back, I will. And so my parents ordered him to come back and he was packing to go back when my father changed his mind. And I'm sorry, I never asked him why he changed his mind, what happened. But he told me that he sat down in a small room with a small group of Nazis and gave them our business and the property we had bought for investment and they for a fraction of their value, and they gave us permission to leave.
So they did get some money from the Nazis, but a small amount.
Yeah, and I don't know what the amount was.
But your father was so clever, he also stashed money in different banks,
no,
correct?
He had sent money abroad.
Sent money, that's what I meant.
Money abroad, yes.
Does that mean that he had a foreboding that the family would eventually go?
I can't.
You don't know.
I'm not guessing.
You were very young.
What I know is that he sent money abroad, and that's all I know. But he did it obviously because of this.
Right. So they go to Antwerp. Were they on tourist visas or what kind of visas?
They didn't have any visas, as far as I know. My brother had a 3 or 4 day tourist visa. My parents and I had nothing. So we came to Antwerp and we took an apartment there in an Orthodox neighborhood because I visited the neighborhood in 2011. And it's an Orthodox neighborhood and we lived there, and my father spent months trying to get into a business. And my father was always a terrific businessman, But fortunately, now I realize nothing worked out for him.
Was it because he was Jewish?
I've never heard that. He just tried different things. He tried the raincoat business. He tried everything, and he went back to Germany, and some people said to go to Israel, and tried different things that he and my brother would do, and just nothing worked out. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, my brother was running around like crazy, trying to get us permission to be legally in Antwerp. And the man in charge of that was a man named Robert DeFoy, and he was head of an organization called the Surety Publique, and it is similar to our FBI. And the head of that was a guy named Robert DeFoy. And he was not interested in Jewish refugees coming to Belgium for two reasons. One, he was an anti-Semite. And two, he didn't want foreigners coming to Belgium and competing with Antwerp businessmen. So he turned down our request to remain in Belgium. And I have all those papers and I've seen them. I was in the archives. I have all those documents.
So then what? Where are you going to go next?
So he just turned down our request. And after he turned down our request, he went to Camille Huysmans, the mayor of Antwerp, a very fine man who subsequently became prime minister of Belgium. And he asked Camille Huysmans to deport us to Poland.
Why Poland?
Because my parents came from Poland.
Right.
And Camille Huysmans was a socialist. And he was sympathetic to the Jews, and he refused to execute the order to deport us.
Lucky for you.
Very lucky for us. So then Robert DeFoy went to the federal police and gave them an order to deport us. And when they came to our apartment to deport us, we were on the Red Star Line's SS Westernland en route to the United States.
We're going to stop there for a moment because we have to take another break. I want to thank Triforce Pictures for their generosity in providing video and audio services for the Holocaust testimonies. This is Milk and Honey on WSRQ, the voice of Sarasota Manatee.
I never loved nobody fully. Always one foot on.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Sonia Pressman Fuentes about getting on the boat from Antwerp to the United States right before this man was trying to deport the whole family back to Poland. But how did you manage to get on the boat to the U.S.? Do you have any information about that?
It wasn't before. Well, he had already been trying to deport us.
Right.
And now what did you ask me?
How did your family manage to get permission to go to the U.S.?
I don't have a lot of detail about that. I have my brother's diary. I know that we came to the United States on Polish passports, Polish visas. Mm-hmm. More than that, I don't know, but I know that my brother went to different organizations and he ran around and we were able to get on a ship.
Very, very lucky. So you were on a ship run, and we'll get more into this later, by the Red Star Line, which we'll cycle back to that later. So your family got to New York City. Did you have any relatives there? Did you have money? What happened next?
I just want to mention one of the thrilling things in my life. When I went back to Belgium for the first time in 2011, I stood at the shore where we took the SS Westernland to the United States. And that was a big thrill.
Yes.
Now you ask me
so
what?
So you're in New York. Do you have any organization that's helping
you,
family?
Yeah, we landed in New York City. Before we had known for many years cousins on my mother's side in Brooklyn. And my father thought, and they had years ago, they wanted to send us papers that we should come to the United States. But my parents were very happy in Germany and had no desire to come to the United States. So my father thought he would go in business with one of these cousins. And 2 weeks before we landed, or just about when we landed, whatever, that cousin that my father thought he would go in business with died. So we came to the United States, came to New York City, and with the help of Hayas, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, we found an apartment in the Bronx. And my father opened a men's clothing store in Manhattan with a partner, and I don't know anything about that partner.
And then, for how long did he have that store?
He had that store with a partner for about a year and a half.
And decided again to make a career move.
Well, I don't know that you would call it a career move, but my father wasn't happy with his life in New York. The pace of life was different than what he was used to. In Germany, he was used to going home for lunch and then going back, and it was a not as frantic a life as in New York, and he wasn't happy with it. And he also had differences of opinion with the partner.
Right.
I think my father was more interested in paying off debts, the partner was less interested, that kind of thing.
Did he speak English by this time, your dad?
He spoke, I'm often asked what my parents speak, and I'm not sure because whatever they spoke, I understood. He spoke English, he did, but he also spoke Yiddish. But he could speak English, yes.
Mm-hmm. So he was there for a couple of years.
Not a couple of years, about a year and a half.
Oh, okay.
And we went to the Catskill Mountains of New York for 2 weeks vacation. That's what Jews did in New York in the summertime. And then we came back from that vacation, and my father turned to my mother and he said, "We're moving to the Catskills."
And your mother said?
And my mother said, "No way." Throughout my parents' lives, wherever they were, my father wanted to move, and my mother wanted to stay where she was. And if they went to somebody's apartment, my father would say, "Why don't we sell our place and buy here?" And my mother never wanted to go. So that was the same now. My father wanted to move to the Catskills, which was a summer resort, small villages and towns. And my mother said, "No way am I going to leave the city, New York City in the Bronx, to go to a small village in the Catskills." So my father wasn't one to argue. He didn't say anything. He just turned around and walked out of the house. And my brother said, "I don't like the look in his eye. I'm going to follow him." So he followed my father, and my father went down to the East River and walked in to kill himself.
Amazing, huh? Yeah.
And my brother followed him and pulled him out of the water. Amazing. and called for people nearby to call an ambulance or a police. And my brother said that by that time, my father didn't know what was happening. His eyes were rolling around in his head, and he was soaking wet. So then an ambulance came, and they wanted to take my father to the hospital. But my brother said, "No, he'll bring him home." And he brought him home soaking wet, and my mother took one look at him and said, "Okay, we'll move to the Catskills."
Amazing. So your father was such a strong-willed man.
Yes, he was.
So we're going to escalate this a little bit because we have a lot to cover.
Yeah.
You moved to the Catskills briefly. They bought a rooming house, correct?
They rented a rooming
rented
house
a rooming
for
house.
5 years, and they ran that.
And then?
And then my father went to the next town, which was a larger town called Monticello, and he bought 50 acres of land on the Port Jervis Road. It was called Route 42, about a mile and a quarter out of town. And he built a bungalow colony with a home for us and about 25 bungalows, a general store. Sometimes we had a casino there, a handball court, a swimming pool.
And again, became very successful.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but we made a living.
You made a living.
We made
a good living. Thinking about your family having left Germany, the ordeal they went through, luckily they escaped Nazi imprisonment, but they left Germany, they had trouble getting to, you know, anything in Antwerp, they came to the U.S. Was there any atmosphere in your home of depression or sadness or anger?
Well, when we were in Belgium, I got this from my brother's diary. My father was very angry at my brother for taking us out of Germany because my father couldn't find a way to make a living. It didn't work. We were there about 9 months and nothing worked out for him. So we blamed my brother for that. But all our lives, my brother got the short end of the stick, and I came 14 years later. I was always treated very well. But when my brother was born, they were just getting started, so life was more difficult. By the time I came along, they were well-to-do, and I had a sweet life.
Did they ever acknowledge, though, that it was your brother's vision that saved their lives?
I always acknowledged it to my brother, always. I never spoke to him without thanking him. And even today, when I speak to his children and grandchildren, I mentioned
that. You recognize that.
And great-grandchildren. But I don't know that my parents did.
You mentioned that during that time in Antwerp, your father took a trip back to Germany to try to get work. So he wasn't held because, remember, the fear was, you had mentioned that the Germans would kill you if you came across the border.
I don't know if he went to Germany. He thought of going to Germany, but he went to Czechoslovakia. I know he went all over to try to find a way to make a living, thought about it in Paris. I don't know just to which places he went, but I know he traveled around to try to find something to work out.
So luck was really on his side to get him over to the U.S.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's speed ahead a little bit. You are growing up as a young girl in the U.S., first in the Bronx, then in the Catskills, then in Monticello.
Monticello's part of the Catskills.
I know, but you were in another town before
Woodridge
that.
First.
Woodridge, right. So what was it like for you coming from Germany, Belgium? What was life like for you personally, Sonia?
Well, it was difficult for me because my life was disrupted. And here I came, and because we lived in different places, I was always the new kid on the block. So I would join a class, whether it was kindergarten or the third grade or later on, and the other kids all knew each other and had grown up together. But I was brand new. I didn't have any social graces. My parents couldn't really guide me in what an American child, an American teenager would do because they didn't know either.
Did you have an accent? Did you have a German accent? Or
no, I immediately learned English.
So you didn't experience any prejudice about coming over from Europe?
No.
You just didn't fit.
I just didn't fit in, right.
And yet you excelled academically.
Academically, I excelled, but in all other areas, I was zilch.
So you somehow managed to get into Cornell University?
Well, I didn't somehow manage. I was graduated first in my class at high school. I won scholarships, and so that's why I went
to
Cornell.
So academically, you were really...
Right.
When did you find a way to... Obviously, you're very vibrant and able to communicate well. When did you become more comfortable socially?
It's taken a lifetime.
Really?
Right.
How so?
What
say
do you
more.
Mean?
When you say that to fit in, you mean those early years made it hard for you to feel
well?
Like
the
you belonged?
The more education I got, the more experiences I had, work wise and career wise, the more of a mensch I became. Mm-hmm. But it took a lifetime.
How would you say, if at all, did your early life experiences, because you were very young at that time, affected what ended up in, becoming a very successful life? How did that impact you?
Well, it made me, from an early age, know about invidious discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so I have devoted my life to fighting for civil rights. Initially, I was involved in the civil rights movement for blacks. And for over 50 years, I've been involved in the movement for women's rights.
And we're going to get into that in just a few moments. We have to take another break. We'll be back shortly to find out more about your life. We haven't mentioned yet that you became a lawyer and all that followed. This is Milk and Honey on WSRQ, the voice of Sarasota Manatee.
Start it.
Welcome back. I'm Joan Lowry, and I have Sonia Pressman Fuentes with me, and we're catching up to her life as graduate of Cornell, and you ended up going to law school at a time when that was very unusual for women.
Yes.
What year was that? Tell me about that process, please.
Well, I got out of Cornell in 1950, and it meant a lot to me that I had a college education. I thought that was a big deal. And that people would be lining up to hire me. And I sent out 200 resumes and letters and didn't get a single response. I didn't know that people weren't hiring women college graduates for professional jobs or some kind of jobs in those days. So So for 7 months I couldn't get a job. And then I went to shorthands. I went to the Brown Business School in Hempstead, New York, on Long Island. And I took shorthand because I'd already taken typing in high school. And I finished my shorthand course. I made a record there. I finished shorthand in 2.5 months with a terrific speed. My mother used to help me, but she used to read to me, and I'd write it in shorthand. So I finished the shorthand course in 2.5 months on a Friday, and Monday I had a job. That shows you that there were jobs for women as secretaries,
right.
But not...
But how law school?
Huh?
How did you get to law school?
So then I worked on and off in different secretarial jobs for a period of 4 years. Because I used to leave, I either didn't like the jobs, or I used to leave the job and go to Miami Beach with my parents for the winter. And I had some jobs where they held the job open for me, and others where I didn't. So that was 4 years of being a secretary, which was fine with everybody else. When they asked me what I did, I said I was a secretary. That was fine for a woman to do. It was acceptable, it was appropriate. But I felt, with college, that I should be doing more than being a secretary. So my parents had had a husband-wife legal team in the Catskills because they invested in second mortgages. So I had the role model of a woman lawyer. And I had interests in law from professors I'd had. And we went to Miami Beach for the winter. So one time I drove by the University of Miami Law, in Coral Gables, and it was a lovely campus. And I thought, oh, it would be nice to attend here. Whenever I see a college, I always would like to attend there. But then I had to tell myself, I'm already graduated from college. I can't go there.
Right.
And then I said, but I could go if I went to law school. So a lot of factors in my life came together, and I decided to go to law school.
And you got into law school at the time. What year are we in now?
54.
54. How many women were in your law school class?
About 11% of the class.
11%, which I don't know what number that amounted to in reality.
Well, I don't know. I'd have to look up. I have records on it, but I don't know where that is.
So fast forward, you graduate from law school, and you end up working in for the government.
Right, federal government.
Federal government. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was accepted for the Attorney General's program for honor law graduates, and I went to Washington, D.C. in 1957. And I worked in a section of the Department of Justice called the Office of Alien Property. And I was a lawyer in that agency.
But then you ended up working on civil rights.
Well, because my life had been saved from the Holocaust.
Yes.
And because my parents planned to have an abortion when my mother became pregnant with me because she'd already had 7 abortions. And... The abortionist wasn't in town, so they didn't have it.
Yeah.
And because I was bright, it meant to me that my life had been saved because there was something I was supposed to do. And I knew that from the time I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell anybody because they would have thought I was nuts. And I knew I couldn't just get married and have a family because I was saved to do something. So when I was working for the federal government, I was always looking for that job where I was supposed to be. So I worked for the Justice Department, I worked for the National Labor Relations Board, and then I got a job with a brand new agency called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And that agency was administering a brand new law called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibited employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin.
So you found your calling.
I found my calling.
Well, and there's a lot more we could say about that, but we have a bit more to cover. You did, though, very importantly, so you found your calling, and somehow you connected with Betty Friedan and started the National Organization for Women.
I was one of 49 co-founders of the National Organization for Women.
Briefly, how did that come about?
Well, I was working at I was the first woman attorney in the Office of the General Counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission called the EEOC. Betty Friedan had published her groundbreaking book, The Feminine Mystique, in 1963. I joined the EEOC on October 4th, 1965, 3 months after it opened for business. Sometime after that, either in the end of 65 or the beginning of 66, Betty Friedan came to the EOC to interview my boss, the general counsel, and his deputy. She wanted to write a second book, a follow-up to The Feminine Mystique, which she thought would detail all the progress women had made since the Feministique was published. So she came to the office to interview the general counsel and the deputy, but she saw me. There were only four people in that office: the general counsel, the deputy, myself, and a junior attorney. So she saw me, a woman, standing there, and she came over to me and said, "What are the problems here? What are the conflicts? What's going wrong?" And I said to her, "If I tell her what's going on here, I might lose my job." Mm-hmm. So I told her everything's fine. But then she came back a couple of weeks later, and what was going on at the EEOC was that they were not enforcing the sex discrimination prohibitions of the statute. And there were two reasons for that. One was that the sex discrimination prohibitions raised more complicated issues, and the commissioners didn't really know how to resolve them. And the other reason was that there were about 100 employees at the EEOC headquarters at that time, and most of them had come there because of the civil rights movement, and the act had been passed because of the civil rights movement, and they came to the commission to do things for African Americans. And they didn't want to be distracted, and they didn't want their time and money spent on this thing about sex discrimination.
So what happened? So then you reconnected with Betty?
Not reconnected. I connected with her.
You contacted her.
And when she came in the second time, I took her into my office, and I told her what was going on at the commission, that they were not enforcing the law for women. And I told her that what this country needed was an organization like the NAACP to fight for women.
And you started the organization, you said, with
49. I didn't start it.
You said you co-founded it.
I was a co-founder.
Right.
Other women felt the same way. Mm-hmm. And in 1966, at two meetings in June and October, we founded NAACP.
So we only have a few moments left. So I want to kind of update to today. You wrote a book about your family history. Tell me a little bit about that.
And I wrote a book about my parents' lives and my own life and the EEOC, and it's called Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter. And I have a copy here if you'd like to see it.
You've given me a copy. And today, you're living in Sarasota. You're 88 years old. You're still as vibrant as ever, I imagine. You're still an activist. What are you doing these days?
Well, I'm very often being interviewed, and I'm very often giving speeches. Between now and the end of the month, I'm giving 3 speeches.
On what?
The first one will be at a Coast Guard facility in St. Petersburg, Florida, August 26th, which is Women's Equality Day. We are celebrating the 96th anniversary of women's getting this right to vote in this country by the enactment of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. So I will be talking to the Coast Guard about the women's rights movement, its past, its present, and the problems that remain.
So would you say, Sonia, like father, like daughter, that you have that same drive and resilience and resourcefulness as your dad had?
Well, when my families thought about it, we always felt that my brother took after my mother and I take after my father. But I like to think I have some traits from my mother, too. But I am more like my father, yes.
Yes. And so what would you like your legacy to be?
I hope my legacy will be what I've done for women.
What you've done for women and continue to do for women.
Thank you.
Sonia, I want to thank you for sharing your story with us. It's certainly a testimony of courage, strength, resilience, and standing up for what you believe is right, and it's very inspiring. Special thanks to Triforce Pictures for their generosity in providing video and audio services for the Holocaust testimonies. They make feature films, commercials, business videos, and wonderfully crafted wedding films. The Jewish Federation of Sarasota Manatee is a nonprofit organization whose mission is saving Jewish lives and enhancing Jewish life in Sarasota, Manatee, Israel, and around the world. If you missed a part of the show and would like to listen again, a podcast will be available Monday afternoon on WSRQradio.com and on our website, which is jfedsrq.org. Good morning.